23rd in Semlin. But until that time, we had been living just across the street from Victoria Park over here. And at that house were two trees, two very large trees that spread their canopy over most of our sky. The one in the front of the house is a Norway maple, and the one in the back is a red oak. And one of my favorite things to do was to look up into their canopies and be still. Even better was lying in the hammock with one of my children, being still and looking up. It was there that I told our oldest daughter, Nienna, that we were going to move, and it was then that she cried on my shoulder. And once I was being still in the hammock with our youngest child, Maya, and I was considering the oak and its age. Something about the oak was numinous, it was other, it was powerful, in a way that kind of made me want to trust it. And it reminded me of a passage from John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie, where he discusses the giant redwoods of California. And I quote here at length, "The redwoods, once seen, leave a mark or create a vision that stays with you always. The feeling they produce is not transferable. From them comes silence and awe. They carry their own light and shade. The vainest, most slap-happy and irreverent of people in the presence of the redwoods goes under a spell of wonder and respect. Respect, that's the word. To me, there's a remote and cloistered feeling here. One holds back speech for fear of disturbing something. What? I can accept these trees and their power and their age because I was early exposed to them. On the other hand, people lacking such experience begin to have a feeling of uneasiness here, of danger, of being shut in, enclosed, and overwhelmed. It's not only the size of these redwoods, but their strangeness that frightens them. And why not? For these are the last remaining members of a race that flourished over four continents as far back in geologic time as the Upper Jurassic period. And only these few are left. A stunning memory of what the world was like once long ago. Can it be that we do not love to be reminded that we are very young and callow in a world that was old when we came into it? And could there be a strong resistance to the certainty that a living world will continue its stately way when we no longer inhabit it?" End quote. So, when I considered the oak tree, I had a similar feeling to what Steinbeck was describing. And being who I am, I had to find out how old this tree was. And so I used data from the city and an online estimator, and it came out a little shy of 200 years. 200 years. In the age of the world, just a blink. But then I began to think of what 200 years had done to the landscape around this oak and its neighboring maple, which is not much younger. And 140 years ago, in this neighborhood where we are right now, was a woodland, part of the land of the Musqueam, the Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh, as it still is. And it was logged in 1880, and creeks and swamps were drained, including at Victoria Park, I think, and European settlers moved in. And the rest is fairly common knowledge. But this tree, this giant, bore silent witness to it all. It stands as a reminder of something, that we, not it, are fleeting. It critiques us somehow. Its age, its strength, its otherness is all prophetic. It lays bare our waywardness and wrongdoings in this land. It exposes our pride, our vain ambition, our sense of progress. And in case you're wondering now whether I've forgotten about the Bible and gone crazy worshiping trees, here's where our feet start treading a more familiar path again. And I say more familiar because some of it will, I hope, remain strange enough to unsettle us a little, enough to witness to something different. So, in the early part of Israel's life as a people, they told stories about their God Yahweh that made sense of their world. They, like the people around them, told those stories in the genre of myth. And you may have heard me say this many times, the word myth does not mean false. It's a genre, in this case, a mode of story. Now, the mythic stories they told involved their god Yahweh in battle. Battle against the forces of chaos. And this chaos usually is associated with the sea, understood to be this subterranean sea that threatens to flood the world and destroy it, hence chaotic. And often chaos took the form of some other being, usually a sea monster, named sometimes, you may recognize as Leviathan or Rahab, or sometimes just called a serpent or a dragon. And this came up in our reading from Psalm 74. But why these images? God defeating a chaotic monster. Well, the world Israel knew was, in many ways, threatening. It was very different from our own world, especially for those of us here, those of us with perhaps a great deal of privilege buffered from the threats of the world. Israel was at the mercy of invading armies, bandits on the road, wild beasts who would attack lone people, centralized governments padding their pockets by plundering their own people. Maybe some of this is familiar too. And maybe most of all, the weather. Droughts, scorching winds, rains out of season, crop-destroying hail, locust plagues, and more. All of these things threatened the livelihood of people. And so they looked to their God, and they told stories of hope. Yahweh was not threatened by chaos. Yahweh defeated chaos. Some stories go so far as to say that Yahweh created the monsters as playthings, like in Genesis, suggesting complete dominion over them. And many centuries later, late in Israel's story, around the year 170 BCE, long after their exodus from Egypt, after the settlement in the land, their monarchy, after the exile and return, after Alexander the Great had conquered the land, they found themselves under threat of the Seleucid Empire, an offshoot of Alexander's empire, Alexander the Great. And this empire, like the others before it, wanted the land's wealth, whatever it had. It wanted subservience. It wanted loyalty. And under one of its kings, Antiochus Epiphanes, it wanted worship. According to one story, this king, Antiochus, tried to sacrifice a pig, which is taboo for the Israelites, on the altar in the Jerusalem temple. And at this point in Israel's history, in the midst of great tribulation at the hands of this Antiochus Epiphanes, we get Daniel chapter 7. And as you already heard from the scripture reading, Daniel 7 tells of a vision containing four great beasts arising from the sea. A lion with eagle's wings, a devouring bear with great tusks, a leopard with four wings and four heads, and an even more terrifying fourth beast, smashing and destroying everything in its wake, nastier than any of the other beasts. And it had many horns, one of whom put down the others and spoke blasphemously. But then the Ancient One, or the Ancient of Days, takes the throne and judges the beast and puts it to destruction. And then a son of man, or a human one, comes with the clouds and is given eternal dominion, glory, and kingship over the whole world. And so we have here in Daniel 7 these four beasts that come from the sea. And while it would take a very long time to try to explain all the different weird imagery that we at least partly understand, it's mostly important today that we understand that the second half of the chapter that we didn't get to read yet interprets the dreams and interprets these monstrous beasts as four kingdoms or empires. They represent in turn the Babylonians, the Medes, the Persians, and finally the Greeks. And then the Greeks, there's all these horns, and they're finally represented by this last blasphemous horn, and that is our friend Antiochus Epiphanes, the nastiest of them all, in their opinion. Now, these kingdoms are represented very intentionally as beasts, as monsters, rather than as humans. They recall this chaos monster of old, whereas the Ancient One and the Son of Man, or human being, are represented as humans who defeat the monsters. The author of this chapter saw the wickedness of the empire, watched as it destroyed his people, took everything they had, slaughtered dissidents, and then this author spoke up. This author had the courage to speak truth into that moment, a truth that undermined the imperial claim to power. It is just another beast. Our God defeats these beasts, just as of old, and so also now. So Daniel 7 speaks into the moment of the worst tribulation. It stands in the midst of it and hopes for a better future. It hopes for deliverance. And history actually tells us that the Jewish people at this point, they were delivered from that empire, though not exactly as they had perhaps expected. They did have a successful revolt. They set up their own kingdom for about a century, and then through infighting, lost power and were taken over by Rome. And this was the world as Jesus knew it. And this was the world as the early church knew it. Caesar victorious, Caesar supreme, Caesar the object of worship. And at different moments, in different places, Christians were under threat because they did not worship Caesar and because they questioned the abuses of empire. And this is where we find John, the author of Revelation. I think Curtis over there has the icon. John has been exiled, presumably because he was an agitator in Ephesus, where worship of the emperor was on the rise. John, like the author of Daniel 7, witnessed the terror inflicted by Rome on any who opposed their practices, including Christians. John had the courage to speak. In Revelation chapter 12, John describes a dragon who fought against the host of heaven and was cast down and began to make war against the people of God. The dragon is just like the dragon of myths passed down through the generations. And then John says, "Then the dragon took his stand on the sand of the seashore. And I saw a beast arising out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads. And on its horns were 10 diadems, and on its heads were blasphemous names. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And the dragon gave it his power and his throne and great authority. They worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?' It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And then I saw another beast that rose out of the earth. It had 2 horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon." So here in chapters 12 and 13 of Revelation, the dragon is set on the shore of the sea, a familiar image. And out of the sea comes this beast and the second one after it. And the first beast looks unmistakably like a composite of all of Daniel's beasts. The interpretation is clear. This beast is all the nastiness of Daniel's imperial beasts assembled in one devastating monster. And this beast, like Daniel's, is an empire. Rome. And Rome, in all its power, robes itself in the domination of the weak. It crushes its opponents. But John speaks. John says, like in Daniel, that this empire too will fall. That the God of justice, who protects the weak, who defeats monstrous forces, will defeat the beast and the second beast, its prophet. And not only that, but God will defeat even the dragon that lies behind these beasts and all beasts. Later in Revelation chapters 19 and 20, the beasts and the dragon are thrown into the lake of burning sulfur. They are destroyed. Gone. And then God does something uniquely different. After destroying chaos, as in the beginning, so also now, God creates. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "See, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them. They will be his peoples, and God himself will be with them. And he will wipe every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away." This is the God of Revelation, the God of Daniel, the God of Israel, our God. No empire, no monster, no force of chaos or evil will stand before Yahweh. And we can take heart from knowing who our God is. When we are faced with the evils of our day, be they white supremacy, patriarchy, economics of greed and exploitation, human-induced climate change, social isolation, crushing poverty, colonization, Islamophobia, homophobia, and transphobia, when we are faced with them, we know that God will defeat them. We know that the way of Christ, the way of inclusion, care for the marginalized and oppressed, this way is more powerful. But the way God defeats these evils is and always has been a sticking point. In reality, God does not go about slaughtering flesh and blood enemies. John, in Revelation 5, describes a different way. In the heavenly throne room, in Revelation chapter 5, all are desperate for someone to act in history to defeat evil. And in John's imagery in Revelation, this is, they are waiting for someone to open the seals of the scroll. And as they are all longing for someone to open it, John sees something unexpected. "Then I saw in the right hand of the one seated on the throne a scroll written on the inside and the back, sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, 'Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?' And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep bitterly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. Then one of the elders said to me, 'Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered, so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals.'" The Lion of the tribe of Judah. This is royal language. But it is also beastly language. A monstrous lion on our side can surely destroy the monsters of the other side. But we read again, "Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals." And then I saw, between the throne and the four living creatures and among the elders, a lamb standing as if it had been slaughtered, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. He went and took the scroll from the right hand of the one seated on the throne. And he opened it. Not the lion they expected, but the lamb who was slaughtered. God, who died at the hands of Rome, at the hands of empire, to put an end to the dragon, every dragon, all beasts, all forces of chaos. This is the story of our God. A God whose self-sacrifice denies power to all the forces that crush God's creation. This is who God is. And who will we be in all of this? Daniel and John, for their parts, were critics. They critiqued the evil of empire. They had the courage to speak. And it is our habit, perhaps, to identify with the people of God in these stories, with the courageous critics or with the oppressed. But I think we all know that sometimes, when we ought to be the critics, we may actually be the monsters. We may be perpetrators of hate, of violence, and indifference. We benefit from empire, from the chaos that others face. And sometimes that benefit shows up in the clothes on our backs, the food in our fridge, the land we own, the color of our skin, our gender, or even our religious practices. And we continue to be faced with the weighty question, are we monsters or are we critics? And the answer is usually a mixture of both. And the crazy thing is, God knows that and loves us. God loves you in your worst monstrosity. But God will defeat those monsters in the world and in all of us. And I'm reminded of that when I think about lying in my hammock with my kids and looking up into the canopy of the oak tree. And that reminds me of another part of God's creation after chaos, the tree in the heavenly Jerusalem. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, through the middle of the street of the city. On either side of the river is the tree of life, with its 12 kinds of fruit, producing its fruit each month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. And so I hear the critique. And I hear the calling. I hear the voice of the trees, of Daniel, of John, of the way of Christ. And I hear a call to courage. Courage to speak. Courage to bear witness to the world-altering way of Christ, the way that defeats evil and brings about creation. Courage to be a part of Christ's body. And I hope that you too may be encouraged. Amen.